Well, good day, everybody, and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we're actually recording three episodes back to back on this particular recording session. And I'm glad we're doing that because we have connected up with the infamous Jim Logan, the Sasquatch of disaster podcasting himself. And we're going to bring him to you recorded live from Las Vegas, where he is attending the ASEP conference and talking about disaster medicine out there. Before we get to that, though, let's go ahead and bring in, you heard her laughing in a little bit in the background, my co-host and the Ed McMahon to my Johnny Carson, Sam Bradley.
Oh boy, you're dating yourself now.
Yeah, aren't we though? Well, I think we all got that joke, so that's good.
Well, we all did because we're all old, but you know, that's okay. Yes, we love the Sasquatch, and he's got some good information to share with us, which is very timely given that we just had two podcasts about Joe's experience on his USAR IST. So, you know, we ended talking a little bit about training. So this kind of moves into the discussion we're going to have right now. So we have our friend Kevin Ryder with us and Dr. Joe. Have you recovered, Dr. Joe, since we talked to you last?
I have recuperated from the last podcast, yes.
All of 10 minutes ago.
Well, he did get a sandwich, so, you know, he's getting his sugar back up, so it's all good. So, hi, Kevin.
Howdy.
I was
just about to grab the sandwich.
Well, you can wait for a few minutes.
Yeah, I can wait.
See, he's saying hi now, howdy now, because he's from Texas. He didn't say that when he was in
New Jersey. I'm in Texas. I could say, how you doing, if that would be better.
You'll just confuse us. So, Jim, the Sasquatch, yes. We're so glad to have you back. Yeah. We did get a podcast with you at EMS Expo, and then you ran off and did your thing, and Joe Holly ran off to parts unknown with Hurricane Matthew. So what are you working on out there?
So I'm part of the National Disaster Life Support System Revision Team, and I'm currently working on the core disaster life support course right now. So I guess many of you that are listening have either taken or considered taking that class, and we're just trying to make it better.
I have, but it's been a really long time. So I hear you're kind of changing the focus of that class now.
Yeah, so I think the revision for the core disaster life support, it used to be that you had to take core before you took the basic disaster life support. It was kind of like a succession type core course. What we're moving towards, because like you mentioned, it's been, you know, such a long time since this course has been revised, is that revision is probably not the right word. It's going to be a new course, and it's going to be community-based. 10 years ago, we didn't have the number of school shootings and, you know, the incidents that we have these days. So we're going more towards making this a standalone offering for the lay public and giving them some background in disaster preparedness, situational awareness, use of different types of tourniquets, both commercial and improvised, and how to use those in the best situation. So I'm pretty excited about what's going on with this.
So we're talking the audience mostly like CERTs and MRCs and Red Cross people kind of thing. Is that kind of who this is geared for?
Yeah. So exactly. And more to, you know, the school administrators, school teachers, all those places where soft targets, you know, kind of hang out. So that's kind of I think that's going to be the focus of this class. So it's in its very infant stages, but, to call it a revision is probably not the right word. It's probably going to be, more of a new standalone course, separate from, BDLS and ADLS.
So you could call it community disaster life support, basically.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. And then your other levels would be for your practitioners and your medical providers.
Correct. And so this would, it's kind of folds into what Dr. Holly was involved in this past couple weeks. I don't know how long you were out, Joe, but it's probably, you know, 2 weeks. But, you know, those folks need to know what to do before help gets there. And I think we've we're a society of convenience, right? So we think we can just pick up the phone as a citizen and call 911. And in situations of disasters, you know, they still expect us to show up. But what do you do before help arrives? That's the question. Those are the life saving. Those are the preventable deaths that we can address.
You're right. And we talked about that when we did the podcast with you at Expo, because it was right at the beginning of Matthew coming in, and we knew there'd be a lot of people out there unprepared. And it's such a valid point. You know, people just think at any point in time during the middle of the worst hurricane, they could pick up 911 and somebody will come. Well, they may not be able to get to you. So, and talking about things like bleeding control, you're absolutely right. That can make a difference whether someone lives or dies.
Yeah, so I think what we'll see in the next few years is, in addition to the AED that you find in your school or your airport, you're going to see a hemorrhage control kit and things like it attached to it, because that's just the world we live in. And the citizens or lay public need to know how to use those appropriately. I think one of the discussions today was, you know, what do we do about improvised tourniquets? Do we teach that or do we don't? Well, the culture that we live in, we watch a lot of television, so that's there. We just need to let them know how to apply those appropriately. What's appropriate, what's not. So it's a work in progress. It's going to take us about a year to get to where we need to be, but we're working with some other folks that are tied into some grant funding through DHS to make this happen, and so it can be a message that's delivered consistently with the best practices.
Well, having these skills for teachers makes perfect sense, and you make the very sad point that I know since I took this course, the world has changed. And, how many stories have you heard about these teachers being with injured people as their only resource until help can get in there? So you're absolutely right. What do you think, Joe?
Oh, I think that's exactly correct. And just to correct the record, my deployment was 4,416 days long. So
it felt like it anyway, I'm sure.
And one sandwich.
And one
sandwich. We're wondering what you ate out there, you know?
No, you don't want to know. So I think Jim, you know, is completely on target here with where this needs to go. It needs to really move much toward a community-based capability and making certain that the ultimate first responders, which are the people that are first on the scene and are on the scene when the incident occurred, have the ability to step up and are armed with the knowledge and equipment they need to do some life-saving interventions.
So, Jim, you know, when you look at putting something like this together from a trainer's aspect or from looking at it from how you're going to implement something like this, what are some of the things you have to consider, you as a committee, you and your group? What are you looking at when you think about, putting this particular program in place?
That's a great question. So it's skill sets, right? So what can the lay public do as far as, you know, the big push these days is SALT triage. That's SALT, not START, right? So those life-saving interventions that come in during that, so what can they do as far as hemorrhage control and airway are concerned? And then, you know, do we need to get into the weeds with the SALT, or is it just more of a global triage? You know, if you can hear my voice, follow me. If you're wiggling, we'll come back and get you later. And if you're still, well, we'll address you first and see what's going on. I think another thing is one of the biggest concerns that we heard today was, you know, people's time. So with the community disaster life support, you know, I think the focus was, generally, the core disaster previously was about 90 minutes. So I think we can do this between 2 and 4 hours. but we're looking at doing some hybrid, maybe some online learning, and then put it with some actual hands-on coming to the classroom. So it's kind of a maybe a hybrid type of approach to adult learning.
That would make a lot of sense. Kevin, I could see this as kind of a basic course prior to your wilderness training. What do you think?
I'm definitely interested in this, and I would love to be. I would love to check it out once it's made available to the public. Without getting into a whole lot of specifics, Jim, what are the requirements to be a trainer for this? Is this open only for a certain team member?
No, I think there's room for what you're talking about, and so we can talk offline. And maybe you have some interest in helping us with the development of this course, so we can talk about that.
Definitely.
But I think what of course there's over 80 training centers across the United States and internationally, and I think you just have to align yourself with one of those training centers, which is not difficult at all. And there was some discussion about, a trainer type course for all levels of disaster life support.
Definitely. We'll get together offline about this. I'm definitely.
Yeah. So we need some, we need some good folks, and it sounds like, so I voluntold Dr. Holly, he was going to be on the committee. So he's part of it.
Well, I'm in too, Jim. If you
Thank
need
you.
an old medic that's been around for a while,
all it took was a Subway sandwich. That's all.
It's a deal.
Right.
So it's going to take a while though before this is.
Yeah, I think our timeline is about it. I think our timeline is about a year. So you know, the world will change. Certainly within the next year, I'm pretty sure. And so there's a lot of moving parts, and you've got to go through the political, maze of all this stuff as well with the different external partners that are going to be involved. So it's going to take a little time, but it shouldn't be it shouldn't be too much.
Well, and you have people from all over the country, so of course, just the logistics of getting those discussions together and however you're going to manage right. that discussion, yeah, that can be a little cumbersome, I imagine.
Yeah. Well, basically, what we're putting out there isn't rocket surgery, as I call it. It's very basic, common sense principles, and people just need to be okay with responding on their own, but doing so in an approved best practice fashion.
Well, I've always contended that. During a disaster, people will panic if they don't know what to do. They're going to walk around in circles and go, oh, my God, oh, my God. However, if they do have some skills, I think it's a natural tendency for them to do that thing. If they know how to put the tourniquet on, they're going to put the tourniquet on. They'll figure it out.
Well, so what you can fall back on with that statement is the Boston Marathon, right? So mm-hmm. 27 tourniquets were applied. 20 of those tourniquets were applied by civilians.
And I'd be curious to know how many of them had actually been trained in some kind
right.
of course, or they just had the common sense to know how to do it.
Yep, exactly.
And that's a really good example.
And not only the tourniquets, but there was that one photo of the guy literally pinching off the femoral artery.
Right.
Just
right.
knowing that hemorrhage control is that important, do what you have to do to stop the bleeding. I think that came into play there, too. That was awesome.
Yeah, and Joe, we've talked about that here on the show before, that the importance of hemorrhage control and how difficult it can be if you don't have training in what to expect and how to do it properly.
Absolutely. I mean, conceptually, it's not a difficult thing to do, but there are an awful lot of subtleties that make a big difference in how effectively and quickly and efficiently you can do it. So, the training hopefully will address those kind of things so that people have a good sense of what it is they're really trying to do there.
Can we imagine a world where if everybody knew the simple process and, like Joe said, the appropriate process of putting on a tourniquet, How many lives would be saved? I mean, we talk about that in relation to CPR, if everybody knew CPR.
Right.
But this is even simpler. And it's easy to teach people. If everybody knew that, how many lives would be saved during a disaster or a God forbid, a Boston Marathon?
Right.
Well, it seems like that's your goal, Jim.
That's been something that's been, I mean, and that's why you're doing this, Jim. I mean, it's something that's been addressed and studied in, you know, all of the active shooter incidents, the bombings, the, you know, from Sandy Hook to the Boston Marathon to what happened down at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. I mean, all those incidents, all right. Aurora, Colorado at the movie theater and San Bernardino, we can start listing them off by name,
but
they all have similar situations that involve some people with some major bleeding. When the bleeding was controlled, people lived.
And so that's a great point, because you just listed, I don't know, I stopped counting at five, right?
So that was good, Jamie.
In recent history, it's becoming increasingly apparent that EMS isn't the answer, right? I know I hate to say that. Isn't the answer in situations like this? What's going to save lives is community-based first response that's gonna plug the holes before we can get there and take care of the rest.
Oh, that makes so much sense. EMS will be the next level up when they get there.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, these events are, very fluid. And, we have to enter with caution or precaution. You know, we're very much better than we were before as far as is the scene safe and all that kind of stuff and securing the area. And moving in when it's appropriate. So that whole aspect is changing for EMS. But as we move forward, it's very important that the public and the, you know, lay people understand that they are the first line of defense in an incident like this.
And this isn't all that different from, I mean, what we've been talking about with disaster planning in general. I mean, we've been saying that preparedness starts with the individuals and with the lay public, and that they need to be prepared to shelter in place and take care of themselves, basically, for 72 hours. Well, you know, what's the difference between that and saying in an active shooter incident or a bombing situation, you need to be prepared to take care of yourself and the people around you for the first 7 minutes until EMS and police and other resources can begin to arrive, right?
I like that, yeah. Yep, exactly.
And sometimes even longer.
Mm-hmm. That's
look
true.
At look at the massive blizzards and snowstorms in the Northeast and how many times the ambulance has been delayed simply because they couldn't get through or they got stuck. Maybe it's like a half an hour, 45 minutes, maybe an hour.
Well, I think, you know, we're focusing right now on, you know, a hostile MCI, but you're exactly right. So you've got blizzard, you have tornado, you have all those other things that you can use these skill sets as a lay person to assist before EMS or fire or law gets there.
So, Joe, do you think, say, in the last 10 years that the mindset of the common man has actually changed with the world changing the way it has with all of these MCI types incidents and strange weather anomalies? Do you think they're more aware and more willing to, because, you know, like Jim was saying, you know, we think about scene safety. Well, if you're right in the middle of that event at Aurora, there is no scene safety. I mean, you're in it. You've got to do the best you can with it. What do you think?
Well, I would agree with that. I certainly think the recognition and awareness by the lay public, if you will, is much better than it was before. If for no other reason than these events seem to be occurring almost on a daily basis. And you know, folks at least now realize that there are possibilities of being somehow entangled in one of these events is much greater than it was 5 years ago. So I would say yes. You know, I think there's still a lot of work to do, but we're at least heading in the right direction.
So, Jim, yeah. I mean, maybe it's a question for down the road, but how would you let people know about this? How would you get people engaged in this kind of thing and convince them this is a really good basic skill set for them to have?
Well, I think that there's a lot of initiatives that are on the table right now that haven't really emerged. One of them is FROST, First Response On Scene Training. The other is the name escapes me. There's two or three initiatives going on from two or three different organizations, but it has to be couched, and I think all of them have to be in agreement with each other that they're saying the same message, and getting that message out consistently to the public. So I think it's going to be just we know those events are going to happen. We know that they're already there. I think it's going to just take, for lack of a better word, a culture change and a marketing strategy from these initiatives to push it forward. And I think it's going to have to come, from top down. It's going to have to come from, your local agencies, even the federal government, HHS, DHS, are going to have to fund these things. And I think there's things that are on the floor right now, and we're kind of in flux for the next 3 weeks, trying to figure out, who's going to be in the White House and, in control of the House and the Senate. So it's going to take those folks to get engaged very quickly to start pushing these initiatives forward.
Well, and what I like about CDLS is there's a continuum. It's not just a standalone, but, you move from that core level. So you have your citizen responder to your next level of first responder on up through your medic and your higher level providers. So everybody kind of knows what everybody else knows. And there's right. more of an expectation when the providers get there of what these people may know and what they're able to do. So I think there's some benefit to that.
I think the gap, though, Sam, I think the gap right now is it's sort of like when we train on the active shooter with Paragon, we had to go back and say, okay, well, so you are EMT or you are a paramedic. Have you heard of run, hide, fight, which doesn't apply to us at a first response level, but applies to the general public. So all those things have to come together to where we understand what the civilian responsibility may be and what our how they intertwine, how they work together. So I think that's what the approach is with this CDLS course is. This is what you can expect when fire and EMS get there. And for fire and EMS and law enforcement, this is what's happening before you get there. That's often the missing piece that we have on our side. Is we don't know what the victims, if you will, are doing.
And I could see you integrating some of these concepts into your training with Paragon as well, because you train all different levels of people, right?
Right, exactly. So what we started doing is incorporating the run, hide, fight concept out of Houston to our first responders, and they're like, oh, so that's what they're doing on the other side of the door, if you will. So, and that was never really brought out.
You want to go into that a little bit, Jim? The run, hide, fight concept?
Was that to me? I'm sorry.
Yes.
So run, hide, fight was an initiative several years ago out of Houston about what to do. I think what they gave was a office complex workplace violence. So if you're posed with that threat, first thing to do is run. Don't be a victim. Run, get out of the way. If you can't run, you hide. You barricade yourself into wherever you're at. You move the copier machine in front of the door. Tie the computer cable to the door to, lock the door, because usually an assailant will not try a locked door. They'll try the locked door one time. If they can't get in, they'll move to the next door. And then if the hide doesn't work with the barricade, then don't go down like a victim. Go down swinging. You got to fight any way you can to get out of the situation.
Yeah, that makes so much common sense. It's just good.
Well, you know, it's really an element of surprise because the assailant doesn't expect you to do that because they believe they have the upper hand.
So that would sort of concept would be integrated into CDLS?
Yeah, so I think that's part of it, certainly. So I think that's an element that could be online or taught in the physical class itself.
So Joe, are your wheels turning on? Gee, we could do this and we could do that, and what about this?
We already are doing this and doing that.
Yeah.
That's a lot of what we're already about. So it's good to see, you know, other courses like ADLS beginning to incorporate that concept as well.
Well, it makes sense to me. Just start with the basics. And it just makes so much sense to get the citizen responders involved because in this world, they're going to be the ones out there. They can be saving lives.
Absolutely, Sam. And you know, it's a good time for us to kind of bring this back around because we've been talking about this class and the training, and we've alluded to some of the things that Paragon's been doing, you know, and the fact that they already are teaching a lot of this and incorporating a lot of these concepts into their training for responders. I'm excited about the concept of involving the lay public more in this process. You know, that idea of if they're going to be self-sufficient in a storm for 72 hours, can they be self-sufficient for the first 7 to 8 minutes of a active shooter incident before responders begin to arrive? I mean, that seems to be, I know that's the average response time in my community is about 8 minutes before EMS arrives on the scene. So, you know, what can they do? First, you know, you run, you hide, you fight if you need to. But then when someone else needs assistance, you know, what are the things you need to do? And this is exciting. So, you know, Joe and Jim, you know, you guys do this kind of thing and you really, it's interesting to see how you integrate new concepts all the time into what you do at Paragon. But, you know, this is something, Jim, that you guys have been, you know, stretching the boundaries for what is acceptable and what is thought of as normal disaster training.
Right. So go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was asking you, you know, to expound upon that. I mean, what's, you know, Paragon's been doing so much. You know, we were just at EMS World Expo where you guys were doing cadaver, you know, training with the cadavers in the conference itself so that people could get some real access to human tissue. And you know, it's just something that we haven't heard about from anybody else really doing it on a regular basis like that and involving that experiential training. And it's exciting, I think, to see that, you know, you've got these other things going on too.
Well, go ahead.
Go, Jim.
No, I was just going to say, you guys are so on the cutting edge. I mean, everything you're doing, it's just mind blowing that you can engage in all these different things and then incorporate that into your Paragon training, which anybody could, you know, that's one of the things I like about what you guys do. Whatever system you're working with, you will tailor it to their needs and incorporate these concepts. It's awesome.
Yeah, I think what we're attempting to do here at a national platform is align all these best practices together. And you can do this in a classroom with a CDLS, a BDLS, ADLS, or whatever. A beacon, whatever disaster format you want to put it in. But what we can do with Paragon is we can pair it with human tissue and make it come to life, which is kind of crazy sounding, but until you put it in action with human tissue, you don't know exactly how it's gonna unfold. So that's, you know, when we combine it with human patient simulators and human tissue and put these concepts all together, it makes no sense to the provider. If that makes sense to you.
Absolutely does, and we've seen it in action. And I heartily encourage people to get an opportunity to see it in action for themselves and bring this kind of training to their community. Joe, where can people find Paragon if they've heard about, you know, what we've been discussing in this episode and they want to find out more about what you guys are doing and how to bring this kind of specialized training resources to their community?
Well, they can certainly go on the web to Paragon Medical Group and get a good sense of what it is we do and how to reach out to us. They can find us through the Disaster Podcast as well. We have a Facebook page for Disaster Podcast now, so I'd encourage everybody to go there and join in with us. They can find us on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group as well.
And I think it's important for people to, you know, as members of our audience, even if this is the first podcast of ours that you've listened to, either to go to disasterpodcast.com and leave a comment on any of the episodes there. We will respond back to you and get back to you and get an answer to a question or a comment you might have. And of course, if you join the Facebook group, all you need to do is ask to join and we'll accept you into the group and we can have conversations over there, not just with us, but with other members of the community. And we've got just amazing people that are already members of the community. They're paramedics and physicians and disaster planners and guys from EOC all over the country and some parts of the world included as well. So we urge you to check that out. Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, the usual social media places, certainly on the Facebook site. And I was just thinking about the fact that, you know, Jim can keep us updated on how this is going. I'm sure there's people over there that would be interested. But you can find me at Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com. Kevin, how about you?
People can find me at wildsafety.com. I'm getting more active in the Facebook group. I kind of dropped off there for a little while, but I'm making a comeback. And I'm always checking out the disasterpodcast.com website, looking for comments and trying to answer any questions I can. And I'm pretty much all over. And there's links to all the social media websites on my website.
What about the PodMedic?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic, as Sam just said, in most social media circles out there. But really, just check us out over at disasterpodcast.com and over at our Facebook group. Just search for Disaster Podcast in Facebook. And, you know, it's interesting, Sam. You know, we've been talking about these types of concepts, but to bring it down to a community level for disaster response to this type of life support, It's one of those like aha moments where you're just like, well, good grief, why didn't we think of this before?
Well, yeah. And it's sad that the world has changed such that we need to have that focus, but it makes perfect sense what Jim and his group are doing and what Paragon is doing and everything else. So, you know, even on that basic level, it's pretty obvious that disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.